It's Friday, July 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. urges a diplomatic solution after North Korea fires two ballistic missiles.
We, continue to urge the North Koreans to resolve all of the things that the president and that Chairman Kim have talked about through diplomacy.
Also ahead, Mark Esper officially takes over as defense secretary. How was Boris Johnson's first day as prime minister? Millions of people go hungry every day. We'll hear where it's the worst. The U.S. government reinstates the federal death penalty. And we'll visit someplace to find your next best friend. That's all on today's International Edition. North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles off its east coast Thursday, a move apparently aimed at increasing Pyongyang's leverage in nuclear talks with the United States. South Korea's National Security Council determined that North Korea fired a new type of short-range ballistic missile, according to the presidential Blue House. The NSC expressed strong concern about the launch, saying it does not help reduce military tensions. At a State Department briefing on Thursday, spokesperson Morgan Ortega said the United States hopes that North Korea will avoid any more provocation.
I think what the president has said, and what the president has stressed, and the secretary as well, is that that we want to have diplomatic engagement with the North Koreans, and we continue to urge the North Koreans to resolve all of the things that the president and that Chairman Kim have talked about through diplomacy. We urge no more provocations, and to that all parties should abide by our obligations under UN Security Council resolutions.
The launches underscore the failure of U.S. officials to advance working-level nuclear talks with North Korea, despite three meetings between U.S. President Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. It has been less than a month since Trump shook hands with Kim at the demilitarized zone separating the two Koreas, a meeting that White House officials portrayed at the time as a breakthrough. Ortega said on Thursday the Trump administration is hoping that the diplomatic willingness evident in that meeting will continue.
What we're hoping is that after the historic visit that the president had at the DMZ with Kim Jong-un and many members of both teams, including the secretary and Steve Biegun, is that we can continue to move forward on the commitments made in Vietnam. And this administration is committed to diplomatic engagement with the North Koreans, and we continue to press and hope for these working-level negotiations to move forward.
The missiles were launched from near North Korea's eastern city of Wonsan in an eastward direction before splashing into the sea. The first missile traveled an estimated 430 kilometers. The second traveled 690 kilometers. Seoul earlier estimated that both missiles had flown 430 kilometers, leading some observers to compare the projectiles to the short-range quasi-ballistic missiles that North Korea tested in May. Those had an estimated range of 450 kilometers. South Korea appears to view the latest missile test as a more serious escalation. After the May launch, it took 2 weeks before South Korean officials referred to the weapons as missiles instead of the more innocuous-sounding projectiles. This time, Seoul is referring to the projectiles as ballistic missiles, which would represent a violation of United Nations Security Council resolutions. North Korea has not responded to U.S. requests to begin working-level negotiations. Instead, the North has continued escalating provocation and threats in what many analysts say is an attempt to improve its negotiating position. Last week, North Korea's foreign ministry hinted that Pyongyang could forego talks and might resume intercontinental ballistic missile launches and nuclear tests if the United States and South Korea go ahead with planned joint military exercises. On Tuesday, North Korean state media published photos of Kim Jong-un and several other top military officials inspecting a newly built submarine that apparently can carry nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles. Among the top stories in the world, key U.S. base at risk as Turkish-U.S. tensions escalate. UK's Johnson rejects Brexit deal, vows to leave the EU without new agreement. 16 U.S. Marines arrested in human smuggling drug probe. Taliban storm security posts as blasts rock Kabul and other targets. U.S. government to resume executions after nearly two decades. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump celebrated his new Secretary of Defense with pomp and pageantry at the Pentagon on Thursday. The president, along with Vice President Mike Pence and Pentagon leaders, participated in a full honors welcome ceremony, including a 21-gun salute for Mark Esper, an Army veteran and former defense industry lobbyist. In remarks at the ceremony, Trump congratulated Esper and expressed confidence he is the right person for the growing challenges of the times.
I have absolute confidence that Mark will ensure that our incredible military is fully prepared to deter conflict and to defeat any foe. No enemy can match the awesome might of the American Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, and the United States Marines.
For his part, Esper said the United States faces a host of challenges, including power competition from Russia and China, as well as threats from Iran and organizations like the Islamic State Group.
The global security environment has clearly become more complex. The free and open order that has preserved the peace and sustained our prosperity for decades is under duress. Great power competition has reemerged as China and Russia seek to displace the United States and shift the balance of power in their favor. Iran continues to sow discord and threaten its neighbors throughout the Middle East. And terrorist organizations like ISIS look for new safe havens to plot against the West.
The secretary pledged to help the Pentagon build up and modernize a more lethal force and said the United States would strengthen its long-standing alliances and attract new partners.
We will do this first by building a more lethal force, one that is increasing its readiness and modernizing for the future. Second, we will strengthen our alliances and attract new partners. A strong network of like-minded nations that are willing and able to fight together is an advantage that our adversaries do not possess. But this means our allies and partners must contribute more equitably to our shared security.
Esper, who was confirmed by the Senate 90-8 and sworn in on Tuesday, is the first confirmed Secretary of Defense since former Secretary Jim Mattis resigned last December. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson spoke to Parliament Thursday, where he vowed to take the country out of the European Union by October 31st.
For the purpose of uniting and re-energizing our great United Kingdom and making this country the greatest place on earth.
For more details on Johnson's remarks and what that means for Britain, my colleague Steve Miller spoke with reporter Henry Ridgewell.
Today in Parliament signalled, a real about turn for the government in terms of its approach to Brexit. We have this looming deadline of October the 31st for when Britain is due to leave, and Boris Johnson again reiterated his absolute concrete commitment to leave by that date, with a deal or without a deal. And he's effectively given himself those limits, boxed himself in, which means Britain's options are now severely limited. Either Boris Johnson and his government must now go to Brussels and renegotiate a whole new settlement. He wants to bin the withdrawal agreement that his predecessor Theresa May spent 2 years negotiating with the EU and come up with new deals on, it looks like, individual elements of that withdrawal agreement, most notably over the Northern Irish and Republic of Ireland border, which has long been the key sticking point. So we have 98 days until that deadline. Boris Johnson says he can do it, that the EU, if they show flexibility, can do it as well. It's in everybody's economic interest. But it would be break all records to have some kind of withdrawal agreement, some kind of trade deal done in that short amount of time.
What was Parliament's reaction from the opposition party after Boris Johnson laid out this message?
The opposition opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn spoke directly after Boris Johnson and accused him of being disingenuous on Brexit, of having actually voted for this Irish backstop clause when he was Foreign Secretary and when he was in government and on the back benches previously under Theresa May's government. And he warned that Boris Johnson's red lines made it much more likely that Britain would leave with no deal from the EU on the 31st of October. And he said that under those circumstances, Labour would campaign to remain within the European Union. The opposition, the main opposition Labour Party, are treading this difficult line between not wanting to alienate their own supporters who voted for Brexit, but also trying to remain critical of a conservative Brexit policy. And you're seeing that really hit them at the ballot box as well. The polls show that the traditional political system in Britain is in a tailspin. We've got minor parties, parties that have only just started this year, like the Brexit Party, polling in the lead in some recent polls. The Liberal Democrats, who were on 8% not so many months ago, now up to 23%. They want to stop Brexit altogether. So the whole political process in the country is in a great state of flux. This appointment of Boris Johnson as the new Prime Minister has added a new layer to that. And I think there is an increasingly likelihood that there will be a general election in Britain.
Well, what would a general election do to the Brexit process?
Well, I think the EU, seeing that there would be a change to the democratic system in this country, they would probably allow an extension to the Brexit deadline, despite Boris Johnson's objections. And then it's anybody's guesses as to who might win that. Most polls suggest that no one party will get a majority. So we could just be back to square one, where all the parties, or whichever party is able to form a government, will have to rely on the support of others.
That's Henry Ridgewell talking with my colleague Steve Miller for VOA from London. An estimated 820 million people did not have enough to eat in 2018. That's up from 811 million the year before. That marks the third year of increase and underscores the immense challenge of achieving the Sustainable Development Goal of zero hunger by 2030. That is one of the major findings of the latest annual State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World report, jointly released by several UN agencies, including the World Health Organization. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Dr. Francesco Branca, who is the WHO's Director of Nutrition.
We have a global figure of about 820 million. And, you know, given the size of the population, the majority of these 820 million people live in Asia. 514 million people live in Asia. So although the proportion is higher in Africa, the actual numbers are much higher in Asia. So that's an overall figure.
Number one, why in Asia? And number two, why are the numbers which had been going down going up again?
The reason why we have the largest number in Asia is merely the, you know, the large population of Asia.
What geographic areas of Asia are most affected?
The areas most affected are the Asia in the south. And here I would like to also add another number. What I've just given you are the people who are affected by undernourishment or perception of food insecurity. In other words, these are people who do not have enough food or perceive to not have enough food to eat. But then there's another number, and that's the number of actually people who are malnourished. So we've measured, we have data on the measurement. And we know that particularly in children under five, who are the most vulnerable population, we have children under five who are failing to grow well, and you know what we call the stunted people. And in Asia, we have 81 million of stunted children out of the total number of 149, and also we have in Asia 33 million out of a total of 50 were affected by acute malnutrition. So in other words, they are very thin, and they're also affected by a high risk of dying. And the final number is the low birth weight. So basically, we have data now on the birth weight of children all over the world, and we know that one child in seven is affected by these conditions. We have about 15 million in the world. But in Asia, and particularly in South Asia, India, Bangladesh, we have one child in four who is born with this condition. And, you know, this low birth weight is, in a sense, is a life sentence for to malnutrition, because a child who is already born small because of poor in utero growth, that child is going to very likely to be a child with poor growth, with malnutrition, and an adult with overweight and obesity.
Why is obesity going up?
Obesity is not the result of necessarily excess energy. It's actually the result of overall exposure to poor diet. If the affordability and accessibility of the diet is poor, then people, you know, either go to undernutrition, but it can also go to overweight and obesity because the quality of the diet, it's actually poor. They can't have access to the healthy foods, but they would end up consuming cheap products which are high in fat, sugar, and salt. So depending on the, you know, context, the insufficient food may lead to this apparently contrasting conditions. In reality, there are somehow two faces of the same medal.
That's Dr. Francesco Branca, the WHO's Director of Nutrition, speaking with VOA's Ira Melman by Skype from Geneva. Coming up, we'll visit a place where you just might find your best friend. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The U.S. Justice Department announced Thursday that the Federal Bureau of Prisons is set to resume capital punishment in the United States after a 16-year hiatus. Three of the executions are scheduled for December, two more for January of next year. The department said additional executions will be scheduled at a later date. Attorney General William Barr, a fervent advocate of the death penalty, said in a statement that the Justice Department has sought the punishment against, quote, the worst criminals, unquote, including the five inmates scheduled to die. The inmates will be put to death using pentobarbital, a lethal drug that replaces a three-solution procedure previously used in federal executions. Since 2010, 14 states have used the drug in more than 200 executions, according to the Justice Department. Robert Brett Dunham is the executive director of the nonprofit Death Penalty Information Center. He says that pharmaceutical companies have not wanted to supply the drugs for the controversial practice, and there are questions about how the federal government will obtain the drugs legally.
It's really important that the government be open about what the source of the drugs are. It's important that the public know whether the drugs were obtained properly or whether they were obtained by violation of contracts, breaches of contract, or through violating the law. If we're going to have a death penalty, it's important that it be carried out openly, it be carried out honestly, and be carried out according to the law. We shouldn't have a lawless death penalty.
U.S. President Donald Trump has called for increasing the use of the death penalty for drug traffickers and mass shooters, a request the department has since laid the groundwork to carry out. Despite the fact that U.S. public support for the death penalty has declined since the 1990s, according to opinion polls, President Trump has advocated for it. Robert Brett Dunham says that the administration is sending a message not only on law and order, but also on illegal immigration.
It has emphasized the very rare examples of murders committed by immigrants as a way to suggest to the American public and to the world at large that immigrants pose a disproportionate danger to the American public. The facts show that's not the case. The rate of murders is actually lower among immigrants than it is among naturalized Americans and people who were born in the United States. So it's a false argument. But it is an argument that that appeals to a particular political base, and it's an argument that plays into the rhetorical campaign that we've been seeing in Washington.
Among the five convicts scheduled to die is Daniel Lewis Lee, a member of a white supremacist group who was convicted in 1999 of murdering a family of three, including an 8-year-old girl. All five convicts have exhausted all their appeals and other remedies. The last federal execution in the United States took place in 2003. When Gulf War veteran Lewis Jones Jr. was put to death for the kidnapping and murder of a 19-year-old soldier. There are currently 65 inmates on federal death row, according to the Death Penalty Information Center. More than half of U.S. states have capital punishment laws. The United States is the only Western country where executions still take place. 29 states currently have death penalty laws. Last year, 25 death row inmates were executed in the United States. The death penalty has been virtually abolished in Europe, where Belarus is the only country that still allows it. The Me Too movement has exposed how powerful public figures use sexual harassment against the less powerful, but underreported is how international students in the United States deal with harassment on campus. Students from some cultures might face a higher risk because they are more reluctant to challenge authority or create conflict. VOA's Kathleen Strzok talked with graduate Althea Rao from China, who uses her art to express how she coped with sexual harassment and to help educate others.
Althea Rao engages others with art to bring a difficult subject to light. Sexual harassment. It's something the Chinese artist says she experienced while she studied in the U.S. on a student visa.
I had a very unpleasant experience with sexual harassment with a faculty member when I was at school. And then the investigation decided that there was no evidence where the evidence was not enough to prove that anything policy was violated, and then my professor ended up retaliating against me.
She's now an artist in residence at the Art Space New Haven in the state of Connecticut. Althea uses her work to highlight the problem, and she calls herself a cultural facilitator.
We touch, we create, we heal.
Her artwork includes film and video, but she focuses on light sculpture. She asks people to write secrets and declarations on a piece of paper, which she pastes together into the light sculpture. She says it gives a voice to those who have been silenced.
Listening and having an open mind before judging is really important. In China, there's a lot of, in the past, people would say, oh, you are so sensitive. You shouldn't have this feeling. This is normal.
Experts say many foreign students are reluctant to report sexual harassment.
And we know a lot of folks aren't reporting because they're concerned that they might not be believed or that they'll be blamed for the assault or what happened to them. So if they are concerned or anticipate that they might have a negative response either from the university or from the legal system, that might jeopardize their status here in the country, that oftentimes can be a barrier for students reporting.
Rao says it's important for men to engage in the conversation too.
Gender equality is equality about all human beings, and we share space. So it's not about one side dominating the other. And I'm trying to find a way to make more men to understand that they should be part of this. And if we want to find a win-win situation, then they need to be part of this, and they urgently need to be part of this.
Rao said she believes before the Me Too generation, women survived by going along to get along or acquiescing. But that's changing.
Earlier generations of women, they just admitted that, okay, this is the dynamic in order for me to excel, to survive. The younger generation of women, they started to say that we don't like the system, we don't think the system is okay, this is not okay.
Rao says her generation needs to push the edges of conventional conversation to include all voices about difficult topics. And art, she says, is an excellent vehicle for those conversations. Kathleen Strzok, VOA News, Washington.
Every year, Americans adopt more than 3 million cats and dogs. Most of those are adopted from animal shelters. Christina Shevchenko visited a shelter in Los Angeles to get a look inside, meet some of the animal caretakers, and understand the adoption process. Anna Rice narrates her story.
It is rarely quiet in this animal shelter in western Los Angeles. More than 200 cats and dogs live under the shelter's roof.
Anytime a dog gets lost or a cat gets lost, we're the place where people will bring the animals to hopefully get them reunited with their owners. And if for some reason an owner can't keep their animal, this is where they would bring them.
Every day, more than 100 people come here looking for a pet to adopt. They are met by volunteers who feed, walk, and play with the animals.
I started volunteering here after I lost my dog. So yeah, he passed away, and I still want to interact with dogs, but it's a lot of responsibility to own one, so.
If a visitor likes a certain dog or cat, the shelter has special rooms where people and pets can play and get to know each other.
We do what we call adoption counseling, so we try to find out the person's lifestyle and whether or not the animal that they've selected is an appropriate fit for their lifestyle.
Shelters are not the only place where people can find a pet to adopt. Every year, San Diego holds a special animal expo where shelters and animal rescue groups bring dogs and cats looking for a home. Volunteers bring animals to the West LA Animal Shelter not just from the Los Angeles area, but from neighboring Mexico, where the issue of stray dogs is a major one. And this dog was brought to California from Iran.
One of his legs was zip-tied to something, and they had to remove it because it was damaged. But he's 8 months old, super social, super sweet, just a cuddle bug.
More than 120 animals get adopted after such expos. To adopt an animal, the new owner needs to fill in a few forms and pay a fee to cover the vaccinations and neutering. Sandra and her sons came here to adopt one dog, but are coming home with two instead. Although she will be responsible for their care, Sandra says she hopes that adopting an animal will teach her children compassion and responsibility.
We were looking for one dog, but since they're a bonded pair, we decided to take both of them together. I've got two boys, and I think that it worked out great because, you know, we'll have one pup for each one.
More and more Americans are choosing adoption over buying a pet because they know it's a win-win. They get a devoted friend, and a dog or cat gets a second chance at life. For Christina Shevchenko in Los Angeles, Anna Rice, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find other editions of our program on voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. And I'm proud to be the parent of two adopted puppies. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy the rest of your day.
This is VOA News. I'm